serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 99-year-old Leonard Lonergan of Falls City, Oregon. He'll turn 100 next June, but he was 23 when he headed overseas with the 453rd Bomb Group during World War II. When we left off, we were discussing the mission that made him a member of the Caterpillar Club when the young navigator had to bail out of a limping B-24 on October 17th, 1944. Was that a little nerve-wracking?
Well, I don't think you've got time to think of it. Really, tell you the truth, I know that I'm busy thinking of something else. I'm not worrying about the fact that I know I'm going to have to bail out, because I've known that since we've been in Cologne. This plane was all through.
So you knew that then, but it's your job to try to calculate where you can go.
Try to get him behind the lines, yeah.
Because you know if you come down in German territory, your future is not very bright.
We're all done, yeah.
And I'm sure you guys had heard stories of what civilians had done to downed airmen, or how the Germans would treat you if you became prisoners. Had you heard some of those anecdotes?
Yeah, although part of the story is that Goring was very partial to the Air Force, that it was amazing how well some of the Air Force were treated.
If they made it to a POW camp.
Yeah.
But if the civilians intercepted them, they might not make it.
Yeah. No, I was glad we got behind the lines.
And you all survived.
And we all survived, yeah.
Now you're 99 and you've had 75 years to reflect on that mission.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought about how differently it could have gone and how close came?
I always thought, if the Japanese had not quit, had they really poured the power in, we were not ready. What would have happened to the Northwest? It would have been in California.
That's a big what if. I mean, just for you on that mission. Because if that 88 that severs the fuel line is timed a little differently and goes off in the fuselage.
It goes up, 10, 12 feet different?
Uh-huh.
Amazing.
You guys all would have been gone.
Yeah.
And I haven't talked to too many. I've interviewed quite a few guys who had to bail out of their bombers, but not that many of them actually got to go to the site where their plane came down. Was that a little strange to be looking at this plane on the ground smoldering?
No, that was kind of what we expected from what had gone on. Remember, we're behind the lines, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've run out of gas, so it's not going to go very far.
Mm-hmm.
And probably other ones go a little bit, maybe fly farther. If they've got enough gas, I'm sure they may be limping and going to have trouble, but they may hang on for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was a big difference between the B-24 and the B-17. The 17 could take tremendous amount of beating and still keep going. A 24 couldn't do that.
So you survived that, but you've still got more missions to fly.
Yeah.
By the time you were over there, were they requiring 35 of them?
Well, what happened? When we started, it was 25. Mid-September, they decided, with the big help of the P-51s and the 47s, that if you didn't have 15 missions, you'd have to fly 35. I think we had 12 at the time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But they were worth it. The 51 is a wonderful plane.
I can tell you have great admiration.
Yeah.
Because they saved your bacon a few times, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we've only talked about a couple of your 35 missions. I'm sure there are some other memorable moments. I even heard you guys teamed up with the Royal Air Force on some kind of rescue situation.
Well, it's kind of a two-day deal. We had a mission way down in the south of France, almost to Germany. We got a full bomb load, and we're flying down there, and we've got quite a ways down, and we lose an engine. Well, we can't stay with the group. We just can't keep up. We're going to run out of gas. So we turn and we come back. We drop the bombs, take care of a number of fish in the channel. And then, and this is the crazy part, the pilot was only one engine one. He wants me to take him to this big safety airfield that's an emergency deal. I think we could just as well have gone home. But anyhow, we land there. I get out of the plane, and I've still got my heated suit on, and I flick the thing, and the plug-in thing hits me in the head, knocks me down. And I get up, and it starts bleeding, and they start yelling, Purple Heart. No way. At any rate, and that is the last moment of that day for me. So the next morning, we are awakened in the morning, and they say, you need to fly a search mission. Now, a search mission is strictly a one-plane mission done by the navigator, and that kind of made me think, what in the world do I know about a search mission? Because you don't fly many search missions in cadets because you're at a bunch of planes and it's strictly one plane. So at any rate, they have a RAF captain with us. He gets in the plane, he lays down, he's right where I am, but he's laying down looking through the front of the plane. They've given me the coordinates of where they expect to be. So I take him there, and it's near Peenemünde. At that time, Peenemünde was a heavy German deal. So I'm flying up and down the coast and getting a little closer, and the crew is saying, we're getting too close. Finally, the guy says, I've seen him. Well, that takes me about 15 to 20 seconds to give him a good fix, which I do. Then we come home. Good day. Within a week, I got a letter from the RAF with a commendation and thanks for saving 8 pilots on that trip. So that was a really good day.
I guess so.
There's one other story that I always thought is kind of interesting.
All right.
And it was in February. Cold, cold. We should never been flying on that day. I don't know where we were going or why, but we flew the mission, and we had lost an engine someplace, and we're coming back alone. Terrible cold, terrible weather, snow and everything. We come back to the base, and we're running low on gas, and they say, it would be dangerous to land this time. You can't not come in. And I'm thinking, oh, we'll stay up here where it's not dangerous, and everything will be great. So we have to decide now if we can find a spot or whether they're going to have to bail out. We did. We located the radio man operate, finds a spot where we can go. It's just not far. The visibility is miserable. So I'm in front, and I can see through the bottom thing, but the pilot is having trouble seeing. And we're coming in for the landing, and he's coming in on the, like so. And I'm using language that is not very good to tell him what to do. Fortunately, he lands and come down, and we got all the way to the end of there and stop. Wonderful. So if we had gone over, boom.
So he's coming in too high, and
well,
you had to tell
he's
him to...
Coming, yeah, he's coming in angle because he hasn't got a good view of the thing. I'm having to give him directions.
Because you can see. You're closer to the glass.
I can see, and I'm looking right at the glass. Uh-huh. So he lands. Now we have to taxi someplace to leave the airplane. We go a little ways, and it's ice, and the left wheel goes off into the mud. And we sink down, and the number two prop is running. And about as far away from us as that door is a stack of incendiary bombs.
6 or 7 feet away.
And I'm thinking, I wonder what happens if a propeller that's going like that hits a bomb of a bunch of incendiary bombs. That's the last moment I can recall of that day. Who come and got us? Did they feed us? We must have spent the night. How'd we get back to base? All gone. It
wow.
ended right at that moment.
Sounds like maybe it's better that way.
Yeah.
When you got toward the end, when you knew you were getting close to that magic number 35, were those missions the same emotionally? Were they more tense? Was there an expectation because you knew how close you were to coming home?
I think more tense. I know I can remember going in and complaining that we were flying in the slot in one of the next to last or last missions. The slot's the worst spot in the whole plane because they're shooting at the number one plane, and if they miss, greetings. So I can remember complaining about that. But other than that, not a whole lot.
What did it feel like when you actually touched back down at the end of your 35th and final mission?
I went out and kissed the ground. It was good.
You knew you were going to get to come home, huh?
Yeah, and I had kind of ruptured myself in the bailout, so I was having hernia problems. So I come home and had some surgery.
What was it like to come home?
We come home on the SS America. We must have flown to Washington and got out at the separation center.
So you were already discharged when VE Day came, or not yet?
Not yet, no. No, when I came back, I went back to Ellington for some more work to go to Monroe to teach navigation at Monroe. I had my orders to be there on the 8th of May, 1945. You know what day that is, don't you?
VE Day, yeah.
VE Day. I didn't know. I got there, went to the base, and said, I'm checking in. He says, take 3 days off, which was great.
So were you still doing that then when VJ Day happened?
No, I think we stopped with the first bomb.
When you think about it all now, I mean, because at the time you're a young man and you're with all these other young, invincible guys. When you think about it now, do you ever wonder how you made it through all that?
Yeah, that and a lot of other things. During life, there are plenty of things that happen day by day that could just as easily go the other way. So I've always felt that I've been very well blessed. I've had things happen that you just could not believe. But I look at the society today and it scares me. It scares me for my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren. We had two different parties back there that disagreed, but we didn't hate each other. And this hatred is killing us.
Did you have friends that you knew back in the States before you went overseas, or guys that you got to know at Old Buck that didn't make it home from the war?
Well, one of the kids that was one of my best friends was in the Armory at Grants Pass. That's what a lot of kids my age did during the Depression. They joined the Army to get some money. My hope was to go to college, so I didn't. One evening, he decided to go for a swim, and there was a Japanese in the tree that shot him and killed him.
What was his name?
Bobby Coons.
When the war was over, and you're a civilian again, did you take advantage of the GI Bill?
I did. Yeah, finished and graduated. Yeah.
From where?
Oregon. Where else?
And I know you've had a long association with that school. In fact, I know these days people talk about the Ducks football uniforms, and they've had some great basketball teams, especially with Coach Altman. Yeah. But their sport in Eugene is track and field.
It used to be track and field, yeah.
Well, and the new Hayward Field is spectacular.
If they can ever use it.
Exactly. Yeah. If COVID-19 gives us a respite. But you worked in conjunction with that track program there?
For 35 years.
What'd you do?
I was a scorer for the men. My son did the scoring for the women. And I wrote records. Any American or world record, any record that was set, I did the paperwork on. Any record that Steve Prefontaine set in Eugene, I did the record work on.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Jenner, who's now, I understand, a lady. Bruce Jenner, who's now, I understand, a lady. I wrote a world record for him in the decathlon. And then he broke it again in the 76 Olympics.
What did you get out of that? Why did you do that for so long?
Oh, I enjoyed it. And I knew some of the other officials. Bob Newland had been a tremendous, I grew up in Grants Pass. Newland had been a tremendous athlete in Medford, 30 miles away. There just were a number of people that were just real good guys. Wade Bell was one of the runners that made the Olympics in the 800 in Mexico. Got down there and got sick and never got to run. I go to his nephew for my dental work.
How about that? Small world. There are people listening that may know nothing about the history of the Oregon Ducks in track and field, but they certainly know a very famous company that was born out of that track program with Coach Bowerman and a young guy named Phil Knight.
Phil.
Were you around when Nike was just beginning?
Yes, I was.
What was the buzz early on about these new waffle iron tennis shoes?
Well, Bowerman felt that he could find some kind of a shoe that would be better. And I can remember he came in to see me where I was working one day and asked if we had anything like that in Zellerbach. We did not. I don't know how he succeeded getting what he wanted, but he worked on it hard. You know, Phil Knight was a pretty fair miler, but at that time we had maybe five or six pretty darn good miners.
If you go to the University of Oregon now, it looks a whole lot different from the campus you knew after World War II. There's a $400 million arena. There's Autzen Stadium's been fixed up. The baseball park's beautiful. The new Hayward Field. And so much of that has been spearheaded by that guy you saw running the mile. Did you ever see Phil Knight turning Nike into what it is now?
No. It's amazing. Amazing.
Did they ever give you a chance to invest and be a shareholder there?
I don't think there's any question that most of the officials that worked there for under Bowerman that we could have invested if we had the money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But like all money things, I probably would have done it wrong.
Well, you can't take it with you.
Yeah, so I didn't bother to get it.
Now, you had an experience a couple years ago that I want to make sure to touch on, and I don't want to leave anything out. If there's anything else that was important to you, I definitely don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. When you got to go to Washington, D.C. on an honor flight, what was that experience like for you? What'd you get out of it?
That was a wonderful experience. My daughter was kind of clever. She knew what was going on, and I didn't, and she realized that back there one of the evenings we'd have would be a mail time deal where people would get mail. So she contacted all the people in the area to write me letters. But I was given the instruction that anything came with my name on, I was not to touch.
Odd instructions?
Odd instructions. So I didn't really know what was going on. So when mail time came, I had all this stack of mail, which was, I thought, real, real interesting. The trip to Washington, D.C. was fantastic. The Korean just blew me away. I was so emotional.
And when you're at that World War II memorial, and I'm sure you saw the pillar that's got your state, Oregon, on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you saw that wall of 4,000 gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. What went through your mind when you stared at that?
Emotion. I mean, you know these people. I mean, so many of these people are kids that grew up, went to school when you went to school, some of them with you. It was tough.
I'm always interested when someone has reached an age like the one you represent right now, 99 going on 100. When you look back over all that time, is there something that you look at and say, hey, that's what I'm most proud of, or that's what I'm most thankful for?
Surprisingly, I don't know whether it's surprising or not. When I look back, I think there are so many areas that I could have done better. I think of a lot of things I enjoyed doing. I'd love to play touch football. I was too small for other football, but I had good speed, and anything thrown near me I could catch. So it made kind of a good game out of it. I thought just through the years, there are places where I could have put in more effort, where I could have worked harder, could have done a better job. A little late now.
What about what you're most thankful for?
My family, my church and my family.
Rumor has it you've even developed a nickname at your church for something you provide to some of the youngsters.
Yeah, that's possible.
I mean, I've heard of the candy bomber in World War II, but they call you the gummy bear man, is that
gummy,
right?
The gummy bear man, right. Years ago, when the two oldest girls were little, two or three were little, I thought, well, it'd be kind of nice. They sit there and behave so well. Be nice if I brought them some gummy bears. So I started bringing them gummy bears, and there was a bunch of people that sat in front of us with the little kids, and they'd look around. Once in a while, one of our girls would give them a gummy bear, and I thought, why don't I get gummy bears for Phoebe and her brother? So, and then some other neighbors come in, and finally, I cut it off at 40 bags a day.
So it started with your great-granddaughters.
It started with my great-granddaughters.
And expanded to 40 bags.
Yeah, that I've only run out twice in all the time I've been doing it.
Well, I asked you what you're most proud of looking back. But what about looking forward? Is there something you haven't done yet that you're hoping to check off the list or that you're looking forward to?
What I look forward to is probably kind of silly. Since a big part of my life has been enjoying sports, I keep hoping that people like the basketball team and the football team will be able to play one of these days and people will be able to actually see the game. Things have been so good for me that I have very little to complain of.
And he's definitely not complaining about the news this week that his beloved Oregon Ducks will start their football season in early November. That's Leonard Lonergan, 99 years old. I want to thank Steve Roby from Bridgeport Community Chapel for letting me know about his congregation's elder statesman. Don't forget to check out the photos and a short video with Mr. Lonergan at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.